Silence.
Oppenheimer!
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Play Radio!
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 203 of Nerd Pride Radio. 203, the star Alpha Lyncis is 203 light years from the Earth. 203. It is the brightest star in the constellation Lynx, and it's located at the tip of the Lynx's tail. I wasn't familiar with Lynx before now, but you know, having looked it up for this, it's right between the Big Dipper and Gemini, so should be easy to find, and I'm going to look for it next time I'm out stargazing. Because of that location, it's visible at some point most nights in the Northern Hemisphere, so should be super simple to find, and also most easy to find during winter months. So I should be able to get out there pretty soon, I'm thinking. All right, anyway, ask me how I'm doing today. Go on. Ask me.
How are you doing today?
Thank you, Noah. I am awesome. My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D/Pathfinder nerd, a history nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd, plus there's like seven other kinds of nerd. I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You are listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my skull anymore. My co-host this week, it's Hades. God of the Underworld, yeah. He's currently trying to convince me that he deserves a starting place in Dave and Mai's new game, there you go. Dave's and my new game that we're currently developing and playtesting called Godball. Not quite sure if he deserves to be part of the original 12, but Hades is amazingly convincing, we'll see.
He is one of the original 12. Isn't he?
Yeah, we'll see. That's, okay, this was the argument I made. They were trying to convince me that he didn't have a place as the 12 on Olympus because he's not in Olympus. And I said, well, yeah, but at the end of the Percy Jackson books, spoiler, they welcome him into Olympus. So that counts, right? Percy Jackson is part of real Greek myth, isn't it? And then the response was, well, okay, yeah, you know what? Maybe you should account for that a little bit, maybe. But I don't know. I think Hades would make a nice expansion pack. We'll see.
Or maybe he could be like a special thing at the end of a round, like something happens where Hades tries to stop the game.
Ha! Oh my god. Oh wow, a game breaker Hades. That would actually be really cool.
Like, in the game there are events.
See, Dave,
like,
why don't we have him in here playtesting with
like
us? Because he's got good ideas.
Like, Hades comes and summons monsters that will stop your path.
Like, literally, he likes Percy Jackson and Greek myth so much. Percy Jackson was his intro to it, being 11. He likes it so much that on our last book order, he wanted to order the next, what is the series that you ordered? He keeps walking away.
The Heroes of Olympus series.
Right.
There's the Percy Jackson and the Olympian series.
Right, so.
And then, spoilers again, at the end book, there is a great prophecy that is used in
right.
The Heroes of Olympus.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that would make perfect sense. Yeah, you could see that setup coming. And so anyway, on the book order, he went and he wanted to order the entire five-book series so that, A, he could read them, and then immediately after he reads them, he wants to donate them to his teacher, to her classroom, because yeah, that's a set of books that she doesn't have for her kids yet. And so, that's what we're doing.
She has the first book of the series.
Right. Well, now she'll have all of them. So, and if you're going to be my co-host here, does that mean that you're Hades? Because I already announced Hades as the co-host. Are you in?
He'll show up when he feels like it. Don't worry, I'm the co-host, Hades' assistant.
There you go. So anyway, That's it. All right, now it is time for the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast. This is the time for me, when I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week, if something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy week, I add it to my master list, and then the very best stuff off of that list gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. All right, straight into the master list. First up, it's my gaming table. I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. Role-playing games, video games, board games, card games, any games. If it fits on my gaming table, I am here to share it with you. Actually, I hadn't even planned on talking about this. It just occurred to me that we had game night last week, and I finally got to play Santorini. I don't know how much I've mentioned it before, but Santorini is a cool little board game, again, played with Greek gods and the gods of Olympus, and the basics of this game, it's a building game, which makes it a ton of fun. You've got a little board, and it's this strategy building game where you've got a couple of workers, and on every move, you pick one worker, and then you get to make one move with them, and then you get to build one item with them. And that's it. That's all you do on each turn. And the object is, as you're moving, you're trying to build buildings in steps so that you can kind of climb up to the top. And the first person to get up three levels and stand on the third, on top of the third floor of a building wins the game. That's it. But problem is every time you get there and it looks like you're going to make a step up, the other guy moves in and puts a dome on top of it, puts a cap on it so that no one can move on top of that one anymore. Okay, great. Now we have to build another one. And it's very, very challenging and difficult. I played a couple of games of it at game night, and the strategy is really hard. And we had a good time, really good time with it. And Colin, one of the guys that runs the game night, there's a whole set of cards that comes with it, and he says to me that, okay, you know, normally when you've got a strategy game like this, he hates the idea of adding in this kind of expansion with the cards where suddenly you've just changed the whole game and made it weird. And he's afraid that something like that would normally ruin a game. He says, not in Santorini's case. He says, we didn't actually play with the cards, by the way. We left them set aside, just so we could learn the strategies of it before we did that. But he says, once you put the cards in, he says, it really adds to the game. It's really effective. So Santorini is a high recommend from me so far.
Like, there's like three god sets. Simple gods, advanced gods, and golden fleece gods.
Golden fleece gods. We got, Dave, write down golden fleece. We have to remember that for our game.
Oh, like, so, if you get it, you're immune to attacks from other people.
Who knows? Ooh, who knows? Or maybe cool. Maybe the golden fleece is the soccer ball that the gods are kicking around in the first place. We don't have any idea. So, okay, not to get too excited about that. Santorini is currently, they're getting rid of the last of their Kickstarter games, the original production line, and the cheapest I found them before Gen Con was about $60 online, which to me, $60 is way too much for a board game that's as simple as this one. But in doing some research, I found that they've been bought out by another company. Someone else bought Santorini, and whoever that company is, I can't remember the name, is promising to deliver the exact same game. They're not changing anything. They'll be delivering the exact same game for about $35 is their price point. And I don't know when that's coming out. Hopefully before Christmas. We'll find out. But I'm excited. Santorini, again, high recommend for me. Great board game. But the actual reason I was having a gaming table was I was going to talk about, no surprise, Little Starfinder. And
Little Starfinder.
Yes. And Starfinder, again, we've played a little bit, and the kids are loving Starfinder. We're having a great time with the game. We still haven't gotten to our online game. We're trying to make arrangements for that, but we're getting there. And the only reason I was going to bring it up is I was going to bring up the Open Gaming License again. And the Open Gaming License was originally created by Wizards of the Coast as a way for people to create supplemental third-party materials for Dungeons & Dragons 3 and then 3.5. They were all created under the Open Gaming License. I myself have created stuff under the Open Gaming License. I really like it. It makes it very easy to create expansions or even create your own new game, but based on their system. And it's all really cool. And the Paizo has always maintained the Open Gaming License, even though Wizards has moved beyond that for D&D 4 and now D&D 5 or whatever they're calling the new D&D. And Wizards has gone back to a model where creating supplemental material for them is hard, and it's not something that anyone can just do at home like I've done. And Paizo is maintaining the original Open Gaming license. And in doing so, they're actually including more in Open Game content than they have to by rights, and I appreciate the heck out of them for doing this. It has always been their model that anyone can create supplemental stuff for them at any time, and most of their rules, most of the content that they create is available for free online. They publish it themselves on their website, and they make it available for free. You don't even have to give them money to buy their books, and yet enough people do buy their books and give them money that they're the second most successful role-playing game company in the country right now, I believe.
They're co-hosts of Gen Con.
Yeah, no, they do. They do have the awfully big booth at Gen Con. They have the huge gaming room for their Paizo stuff.
Giant ballroom.
So yeah, it was very cool. But the point I'm making is, I love how generous they are with their open gaming content and how that open model has made them more money than otherwise. And I really appreciate it. Like for Starfinder. The new races that they've created for Starfinder are all wholly their own creation, and they certainly have every ability to make those protected content and say, yeah, the basic system is open game because, you know, we built it off of the original OGL, but these races, these worlds, they have every right to protect that content and not allow other people to steal it, but they're not doing that. The races, classes, themes that they've come up with are all part of the open gaming content, and anyone can build on that in their supplements, which I think is amazingly cool. So I really, really appreciate Paizo for doing what they've done. And this is just a little thank you to them. Not that they're listening necessarily, but you know, they might someday.
Paizo, so if you're listening, please, your unofficial mascot, the Gabos, you need to make them official.
They are official. The goblins.
Yeah.
Goblins is the one of the biggest parts of their brand. They always sell new goblin merchandise at Gen Con every year, and they made sure that Starfinder included space goblins with cracked helmets because you got to have space goblins. So yeah,
no,
Paizo loves their goblins.
Making the goblins their official logo.
I don't know. It's enough. It's on enough of their branded stuff that I think they're working on it. So,
yeah.
All right. Anyway, that's it from a gaming table. Next up. Oh, what do I have? Next up is the science corner.
Oh, she blinded me with science.
She blinded me with science.
Blinded me with science.
Okay, I have a few things for the. Oh, wait. I'm sorry. That music means if you don't walk away now, you might be in danger of learning something. I completely forgot that part. So anyway, I have actually several things on the science corner because things just keep cropping up. So we'll just hit them all in order here and hopefully none of them take too long. So first up, Michael, the gorilla. Now, we were just at the zoo yesterday, and so we had some gorilla discussion because that's what we do. And we got to talking about Coco the gorilla, and everybody knows Coco, and she speaks sign language, and she's very cool. And Coco, by the way, is just a little bit younger than I am. So she's 46 now, which, you know, when the average gorilla lifespan is about 35 to 40 years, she's an old gorilla, but she's still kicking. She's still doing really well. And to go along with her is Michael the gorilla, who they were hoping would be a good mate for her, but they never did have the chemistry. But Michael the gorilla is really cool. He learned sign language as well, and is pretty good at it. He is, they describe him as the strong silent type. He's a silverback, and he doesn't speak much, but when he does, it's usually something important. Michael's also a painter, if I've never mentioned that before. My favorite picture of his is a picture called Apple, and you look at Apple, and it's streaks of brown and gray and black, and you look at Apple, and you are trying to figure out why the hell he would call this thing Apple until you realize that, oh, no, his dog is named Apple. Michael had a dog at one point named Apple, who was these same colors of brown, gray, black, white. And when you see a picture of Apple and then you see Michael's painting of Apple, you're like, oh, yeah, no, I see where he got that from. All right, that's cool. I mean, it's very abstract and representative, and yet it makes really good sense. And I love that painting. But the other thing about Michael, and this is something that while we were talking about Coco, we're driving to the zoo, we're talking about Coco, and so Lisa is in the passenger seat, and she's looking up stuff to tell the kids about so that we can fact-check ourselves as we go, and she found this story about Michael when he was younger. He had learned sign language, and they were having a conversation with him, and they were talking about mothers, because I don't know if it was because Coco was hoping to become a mother at that point. That's always been really important to her. But someone asked Michael about his mother, because he had always been an orphan, as far as we knew, that he had come to the, he had been abandoned, and he was found and brought to whatever research rehab facility, shelter, preserve, etc. And he wound up in their program. And so no one had ever known anything about Michael's mother. And so they asked him about his mother. And he told a whole story. Like, he told a story where he's describing in, I mean, obviously very simplistic terms because he doesn't have the grammar we do, but he tells a whole story about being with his mother and running into bad people and, how she was killed. He described that they cut her throat. He described, throat cutting, blood, and that was his mother. And so, tragic and sad, but this is the thing, is that when we talk about animal intelligence and animal emotion and animal, what it is that they know and recognize. I mean, Michael, this is years later. He now has learned language, and in learning language, he's able to take the concept of mother, and he matches that back to his own childhood, his own history. And he can match that back to when he was very little and remember who that person was and understand the concept of mother and know that, yeah, that's who my mother was, because he understands the concept and can apply it. And not only that, but then he can relate a story from years earlier about that person in his life and be able to convey that and the emotion that goes with it to human beings is, to me, astounding and phenomenal. And it touches something in me that is really powerful. Again, he's an ape. He's an animal. And yet, he has language. And once he has language, the amount of things that he can express, the things that he can remember from a childhood where he didn't have language, but he can apply those concepts, floors me. And again, apes, along with, certain birds and, dolphins and other, ocean mammals, they're at the top end of this. And I'm sure we would find, if we had appropriate communication with some of those creatures, I'm sure we could find similar stories like that, if we had a way to communicate with them on that level. But that's the top end. But, when you draw the spectrum backwards through creatures, where does it translate into being a person? Where's the dividing line between them? And anyway, I just really like Michael. I've always liked, obviously, because I've talked about him a million times. I love intelligent animals. I love, sign language apes, in particular. And Coco's story has always fascinated me. Michael has always fascinated me, and this was just a new story about him that if I had heard this story before, I didn't remember it at all. And it, again, took me by surprise. It's very cool. Okay, that's the first part of my science corner. The second part, and this is, I'm not even, I was thinking about the word dude. This is a linguistics talk, so this is the linguistics portion of science. And I was thinking about the word dude and how it is used in conversation. And then to go along with it, dude, buddy, guy, fella, cuz, among certain cultures, the N-word is used in this context, bro, as Noah just yelled from the background. These are all words to connote, someone that you are familiar with. It is a nickname or a reference, but it's kind of a generalized one. But it's also used in such a wide variety of ways. All of these are, to a degree, where, dude is, yeah, you can refer to somebody as a dude, but it's also, there's a use of it as an exclamation, as in, dude! I mean, it's just an exclamation of stuff, or even, use it when you're, you know, when you're expressing sympathy, dude, that sucks. It connotes a level of familiarity, when I say that these other words have been used in the same way, a lot of them, like man has been used this way in the past. No, I'm telling you, man. Something like that. And you can now, oh man, is a common exclamation that can be used that way. And, most of these words, not all of them, but most of them that fall into this category, at least in their beginnings, are specifically male terms. It's like a general term for a male person that then becomes this generalized nickname, sign of familiarity, this whatever it is, eventually becoming an exclamation or becoming other parts of speech. And I'm just fascinated by this and why it is. I read a paper because, you know, while wondering about it, I did some research. And first, it's very hard to find a whole lot of scientific study about the term. But I did find a paper that was written by a guy who studied specifically the word dude. And, you know, he made some comparisons to other terms, but his focus was on the word dude. And he says, yeah, it's specifically a male term. It is used mostly by men, referring to other men, but sometimes by women referring to other women or to men, and sometimes, by men who are referring to women. But it's mostly a male term. And his theory is that these are terms that are used to imply a familiarity, a relationship with another male, while specifically keeping just enough distance to make sure people know we're not gay. That it's that kind of very masculine, slightly homophobic use of it. And okay, that's a little weird and makes me a little uncomfortable because I love the word dude and I've used it quite frequently. Gotten to the point where I've said dude for years and years, and my kids have grown up with it. And for a while, it was weird to hear my kids use it on me. And they're like, dude, you're not going to believe this. I'm like, constantly, I said this how many times? I was like, did you just dude me? But now it's a pretty normal thing. But anyway, I'm very curious about these, and I don't have a whole lot of information on them, other than I know the South Park bit with, the Canadians who run through the, I'm not your friend guy. I'm not your guy, buddy. I've got them in the wrong order, but that routine, I've always loved that. And then I also have found whenever I did searches for this, I found that one scientific paper on it. And then other than that, there's lots of references to the dude map where, they've got several terms, five of them. I think it was dude, bro, fella, friend, there was one other, and you could look at the maps of where those are most commonly used across the country, which I didn't realize how localized some of them were, but they're interesting. If you want to look them up, you can look them up. But I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to, I think, send a note, send an email over to John McWhorter of the Lexicon Valley podcast. He's a professor of linguistics at Columbia, and he has a podcast about linguistic stuff, and I love listening to him. I listen to his podcast. I've read his stuff online. I'm currently watching a YouTube series that he's doing on the entire series is about Creole languages, and he's fascinating. I love John McWhorter. This guy is great. And so I think I'm going to send him an email and ask him about dude and fella and buddy and guy, all of these, and ask him the kind of the history of how these have been used, how they tend to develop over time. What actual classification would you give these words? Is there a term for them? Because I would love to find that out. I couldn't find one. So I'm going to ask him. And if I get anything back from him, or joy of joys, if he actually did a whole piece about it, cool, that would be great. But if I get any kind of response from him, I'll let you guys know, because I find this fascinating. I think it's great. So anyway, all right, that's enough on that one. Next, still in the science corner, I was inspired by a couple of things. One, I forgot how many moons Saturn has that are huge. Like I know Saturn's got, you know, like 60 moons that we know of. Maybe it's up to 70 or 80 for all I know at this point. But It's got a lot of big ones. I mean, Jupiter has the four Galilean moons, the four moons that are big enough to be planets on their own, except that they're not planets because they go around Jupiter, but they've got those four Galileans that I love so much. And then Saturn, I mean, I know Saturn's got Titan, largest moon in our system. That's pretty awesome. But Saturn's also got, you know, in addition to that, there's Enceladus and Rhea and a bunch of others that are, planetary mass objects, big enough that they are rounded by their own gravity. And there's several of them. But, you know, Saturn's farther away. It's harder to see its moons. It just doesn't get the same kind of attention, but it's got some really cool moons on it. And, okay, so I was looking at that. And then on top of that, I was also, this was listening to the Astronomy Cast, and I was listening to them talk about planets, and they brought up Pluto again, and they brought up a whole bunch of cool things about Pluto, but then they also both defended the IAU decision to make Pluto not a planet anymore. And so I wrote a very long discussion of Pluto, a defense of Pluto, because you guys have heard me passionately discuss Pluto here before. And I basically made the points of A, it's stupid to call something a dwarf planet and put planet right in its name while still maintaining that it's not a planet, though. It's a dwarf planet. Well, then it's still a planet, right? Obviously, you called it a planet. Like the IAU decided that, okay, Pluto and Sedna and KOR and all these others, Ceres, all of these, well, they can't be planets anymore because they don't match our definition of planets. So therefore, they're excluded from being planets. Oh, okay. Well, what are we going to call them then? Well, let's call them little planets. I mean, dwarf planets? Does that work? Okay, so they're still planets? No. Clearly, they're not planets. They're dwarf planets. They're, like, even the IAU recognized that they're planets, for God's sake. And they're somehow maintaining that being a dwarf planet somehow makes you not a planet. I'm like, so again, the whole point there is to go along with that is, look, we have already gas giant planets, ice giant planets, terrestrial planets, and dwarf planets. Why? What's wrong with calling them planets? And if you want to rename the other categories, the ones that, you know, the eight that we have that are currently considered planets officially, if you want to call them classical planets or traditional planets or bully planets, I don't care what you call them. You can make a category that defines those that dominate their orbit and sweep out the debris and all this garbage. You can do that. That's fine. But still recognize that dwarf planets are still planets because it says planet right on them. Ah, good Lord, people. What is so tough about that? And then my other argument is the argument that, yeah, planets are inspiring. Planets, when you talk about planets, there's something that has a lot more weight to it. It inspires people. I share my knowledge of the solar system with people all the time because I love it. And when you talk about having, you know, oh, yeah, well, we only have eight planets, but there's, you know, there's several, you know, a couple dozen, maybe several hundred dwarf planets out there but you've already told them these aren't really planets. And for some reason, I know all these objects are still amazing and incredible, and it shouldn't make a difference what exact term you put on them, but it does make a difference. If you could tell them that, oh yeah, we have the eight classical planets, but we have dozens of other planets that we know about, and that our system has right now, you know, probably, oh, we have, I think, 13 recognized planets. We have another dozen or two dozen candidates for planets. And then there's probably a couple hundred we haven't even found yet, if not more than that. That's inspiring. That's cool stuff. And it, anyway, so I wrote this whole thing out and I emailed that to them. Well, I didn't email it. I did it as a message on there. Anyway, it was a Facebook thing, but it's in a closed group and it's weird, but having done all that, one of the things that you may have noticed that I said in there was that we have currently, in addition to the dwarf planets, terrestrial planets, gas giants, we also have ice giant planets, a term which somehow I wasn't familiar with. I mean, I understand what they are, all right? It's Jupiter and Saturn are our gas giants, and then Uranus and Neptune are structurally different, even though I've always been told that they were gas giants, that we had four gas giants in our system. No. Uranus and Neptune are now officially classified as ice giants, which I thought was cool. I'm like, okay, I have no idea what the difference is. Let's go look. And as it turns out, according to Wikipedia at least, The difference is ice giants, they're further out in the system, they are colder, and whereas the two gas giants, Saturn and Jupiter, are both about 90% hydrogen and helium, so they're made of the same stuff as the sun, 90% hydrogen and helium, the ice giants are actually both only 20% hydrogen and helium. They are mostly other matter, which the largest constituent of that is water, which obviously becomes ice, not obviously becomes ice, because it turns out that water gets so cold and is under such pressure in the cores of these two behemoths that the water there, the H2O, primarily exists as, and I'm quoting directly, a supercritical fluid at the temperatures and pressures that are that deep. So these are a lot of the stuff that's that far out. I mean, including lots of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, lots of the dwarf planets that we're finding that far out, Pluto, for example, Charon, Pluto's moon, these other items out there are, most of them, they're a lot of ice. They're a lot of water ice, which is really cool, because apparently there was lots of water ice that far out. And when you get a big mass of water out there, it coalesces into something like Europa or something like Pluto or something. And there's rocks and there's other stuff within it, but they've got lots of ice in them. Whereas when you get enough of it together to form a giant planet, 10 times the mass of the Earth, 20 times the mass of the Earth, they become an ice giant. That's how they do it, with that supercritical fluid at the center. I don't know what supercritical fluid means, but it sounds cool, right?
Probably ice.
Except fluid.
Ice temperatures.
Yes.
Except fluid.
Yes. Leave it to Noah to simplify that for me. Yes. The super cold and yet somehow still fluid. He's got that one right, and now he's left. I just thought ice giants sounded cooler than crap. So, that's what I found out about them. And so on top of this, my last thing, there's just a line here not connected to anything else out here that says, how many worlds are there in our solar system? And I use the word world because, what I'm looking for is how many things are there that are big enough to be a planet, big enough to, gravity, they're large enough that their own gravity causes them to be round or mostly round. It's hydrostatic equilibrium is the term for it. So things are large enough to be rounded by the force of gravity, and yet we can walk on them, or conceivably we could walk on them. So I don't really include the sun or the gas giants or ice giants as part of this, because they don't have a nice solid surface. There is this transition from gas to liquid to maybe a solid core, but maybe not. And they're very weird. But when I'm looking at worlds, when you're looking at things like that, we're talking, like the traditional planets, Earth, Venus, Mars, Mercury, but also the dwarf planets, but also a lot of these big moons like our own moon and moons of Jupiter, moons of Saturn, these other objects that, we can go walking around on them. These are worlds. And I kept thinking that, boy, there should be a good term for stuff like this, that, what do you call something that is rounded by gravity, whether it's a satellite or a planet or a whatever, there should be a term that just encompasses all of those. And it turns out there is, and once I found it, I'm like, oh yeah, I talked about it on the podcast before. It's planetary mass object, which is shortened to planimo, which planimo is the stupidest name ever. And I hope that last time I talked about the word planimo, I said it was the stupidest thing ever, because that's just unwieldy and dumb, and planimo is never going to catch on with anybody. But these planetary mass objects, in my mind, I always think of them as worlds. Just, these are the worlds of our system that we could land on, explore, maybe build a base on, whatever it is that we do with stuff like this. And as I'm looking at them, I mean, there's like a good, if you include all the moons and dwarf planets that we know of and the traditional planets that we know of, like there's easily like 50 right now that are definitely classified as planetary mass objects. And then beyond that, there's a whole bunch that we haven't found yet, or a bunch that we've found, but we haven't gotten, exact enough measurements to be able to tell for sure. Stuff like, anyway. Like I say, I don't know why it was included in my master list, but I just said, how many worlds are there in our solar system? And so, since it was written down, I went out and looked it up just so I could bring it to you guys. So there you go. All right, that That's the end of my science corner. Whew, made it through all of it. So now
for something completely different.
Yeah, something completely different. Stuff I don't have a category for yet. Okay, this one's quick. I don't have a term for this, but I wish I did. The term, Noah's back with a sandwich. Okay, here it is. Okay, I don't have a term for this, but I wish I did. Maybe there isn't one. It's the compulsion to remember exact details as you're telling a story. It's this compulsion to remember exact details, even though those details are completely irrelevant to the story. And it slows things down. And it's something that I work to overcome in myself all the time. I'll be telling you guys a story and I'll say, like, this happens a lot with years, dates. Oh yeah, no, this happened at least 10 years ago. It was back in 06 or something. And then, hold on. No, I didn't live at this house yet, so it had to be, okay, but it was before I had that job. And honey, what time did we move to, the exact year doesn't really make any difference. I've already told you it's over a decade ago, so you know it's around there. And yet, I feel compelled to pin down the exact date, because I know if I do enough research, I'll find the exact date, but the exact date doesn't matter to you guys at all, and really doesn't matter to me either. It just detracts from the story. So,
it's like me telling you guys a supernatural story of, like, I saw a ghost in my house, but I had to work up to it, so I was like, I had a sandwich that had this and this, yeah, then this and this.
That's right. Okay, yeah, I remember because we had just sat down to dinner, and we were having macaroni and cheese that night. No, wait, it wasn't macaroni and cheese. What? Okay, no, we were having sandwich. No? Oh, God, what did we eat that night? Yeah, it's not relevant at all. It makes no difference to the story. And I find that as I get older, I have more of a tendency to do this because I have, a much broader range of dates to remember, for example, a much broader range of places I've been and people I've known. And so it is something I don't want to stereotype this as something that old people do, but boy, older people do tend to really want to nail down whether it was, 1954 or 1951. It's not that important to the story. The important part is a long time ago, a really cool thing happened. Let me tell you the cool thing, and not bog it down with 20 minutes of scene setting. So, not that 20 minutes of scene setting isn't appropriate to some stories. It certainly is, but you get what I'm saying. And so, anyway, that was it. If someone has a term for that, I would love to hear it because it happens all the time. And again, to me, I really try and cut myself off when I do that, whether it's me telling stories in person or here on the podcast with you
listeners,
guys.
Just a quick side note.
Because that stuff is almost always really dull, and it really breaks your rhythm and detracts. Okay,
and
what's your side
note?
Side
note. Listeners, don't try to make this a stereotype, please. We don't want new old people stereotype.
It's already an old people stereotype. You've probably never watched much of The Simpsons, but Abraham Simpson does this a lot when he tells stories, although his stories are always really funny because he's got Simpson writers behind him to make them funny. But yeah, no, it's already a stereotype. All right, that was it. That was it for something completely different. So, it's time for a nerd culture report.
I thought this was bowling for weirdos.
All right, I told you guys I was going to be doing, God darn it, I keep forgetting the, hold on. No, Gonzo, but you're very, very close. Okay, it's a nerd culture report. I told you guys I was going to talk about time travel movies, and I'm going to do that now. And it turns out that talking about time travel movies is a lot harder than I thought, so I'm going to try and make this really simple and just hit the high points. But I love time travel movies. I always have, always will. I feel this compulsion to talk about them all the time on the podcast. Like, I don't know how many times I've added something about time travel movies to my list. It just keeps coming back to me. So I'm hoping that this is me covering it in a complete enough way that I can stop feeling like I have to bring them up.
Quickly,
so, what?
They keep on coming back to you from the future.
God darn it. Yeah, no, he's got me on that one. Darn it. I can't believe I didn't think about that. Before I start in, I'm going to read off, because I mentioned that I was going to do this, I'm going to read off a message I got from Kaz. And Kaz says, of the ones with H.G. Wells as a character, which do you prefer? And he gives me a list of four. The movie Time After Time, 1979, with Malcolm McDowell as H.G. Wells, versus David Werner as Jack the Ripper. I've seen that one. The Time Machine from 1960, and he says George Pal's effects-driven treatment of the novel. I've seen that one as well. The Time Machine from 2002, this one's Guy Pearce being a sexy H.G. Wells in a treatment of the novel. I have not seen that one. And A Great Mistake, a 2010 British movie. Greg makes a fatal mistake and his whole world spins out of control until he's presented with the chance to go back in time and change everything. I have not seen that one either. So, I will tell you, here's the admission. As much as I love time travel movies and time travel in all sorts of media, I have never liked H.G. Wells' Time Machine. I've just never enjoyed it at all. I read it back in high school. I saw the 1960 movie version of it. My wife and I watched Time After Time, the Malcolm McDowell treatment of it, which was not the novel. It was H.G. Wells using his time machine to follow Jack the Ripper into the future, and it was a very different sort of movie. And anyway, I've never liked H.G. Wells' Time Machine. I just don't like the story. It feels dated to me. It feels like a primitive, I don't know, it's just weird. And I did not like the movie version of it. I certainly didn't like the Malcolm McDowell version of it. That just, it didn't do anything for me. It felt a little silly, a little fluff. It was a crime drama that used time travel as a conceit, because it wasn't really a time travel movie, because they come forward in time, and now it's all about him tracking down Jack the Ripper, and there's no more time travel in it, which just annoys the crap out of me. The gimmicky uses of time travel will be in my discussion later. So no, my favorite version of H.G. Wells, and it's not from a movie, it is Helena J.G. Wells from Warehouse 13, as played by British actress Jamie Murray. That is, here goes Noah opening and closing doors again. Done. And I thought Warehouse 13 did a great treatment of H.G. Wells, a female version of H.G. Wells. I love Jamie Murray as an actress. I think she's best as a bad guy. She was very cool in this one. I love the series Warehouse 13. It's super silly, super stupid. But I liked her, and I liked the use of time travel in it. Anyway, that's my favorite version of H.G. Wells. My least favorite version of H.G. Wells is the version of him that used his time machine to come forward and steal my brother's good ideas. Because if I haven't discussed it before, H.G. Wells did in fact, steal my brother's idea for using, Little Green Army Men to play war games in your backyard, and he took that back to his time and created a game called Little Soldiers back in the 19th century. Clearly stealing from my brother. So anyway, it's just an old joke. All right, so now into time travel movies proper. Thank you, Kaz, for the feedback. I appreciate you pitching in, man. But time travel movies. All right. My favorite time travel movies of all time I've discovered, because I listed them all out that I could think of, marked off all the ones I've seen. And my favorite time travel movies, my absolute favorites, are time loops. It's almost always the same sort of thing, that you get something that happens and then time resets and you start over from the beginning, and there's only one character in the story generally who realizes that time keeps starting over. And so now they have to replay these same events over and over and over until they get it right, or until they find the solution or the way out, the whatever. And obviously the most famous version of this is Groundhog's Day with Bill Murray. Groundhog's Day is one of my top five movies of all time, not just time travel movies, but all movies. I have watched Groundhog's Day a bunch, and while it is in some ways a product of its time, there's some stuff that's not as PC today, but it's still a solid movie. Still absolutely watchable today. Still a great film, one that I don't hesitate to share with people. I love Groundhog's Day. But also, in this time loop genre, if you've never watched Run Lola Run, go watch Run Lola Run. It's a great film, German language film, subtitled, and it is really spectacular. Edge of Tomorrow, which was Tom Cruise's sci-fi video game version of Groundhog's Day. Absolutely stunning. I love that film. I've only seen it the once. I keep meaning to watch it again because I really, really love it. Just never gotten to it. I should do that coming up soon. But Edge of Tomorrow is great. Although it should have been named Live, Die, Repeat. We all know that. It should have been called Live, Die, Repeat. They never should have renamed it because they think audiences are too dumb. I don't know what. Live, Die, Repeat is a great title and no one would forget it. Edge of Tomorrow, I have to look it up most of the time. Ugh, terrible. And then those are the three I was thinking of. But there's also two new ones, and there's a bunch of others. I mean, there's Source Code, and there's a bunch of other time loop movies. I've just never seen those. But there are two new ones. One, Before I Fall, which I think came out earlier this year, like maybe in March. And the other one is Happy Death Day, which I think is coming out soon. I think it's coming out like in time for Halloween. And both of these are time loop movies featuring teenage girls in a time loop where they die at the end of the day. And they keep having to start the day over and find a way to stop it. And I think from what I've heard, Before I Fall is a more serious, dramatic sort of treatment of this concept, whereas Happy Death Day is like a straight up slasher movie version of it. But both of them look really cool to me. Happy Death Day. I'm really looking forward to see this. The whole idea of taking a Groundhog's Day time loop, but making it into a slasher flick. Pfft, I'm sold. I'm going to watch that thing. So, that's time loops. Now, my next favorite type of time travel movie is any movie where the past is immutable, where you cannot change the past, but people keep traveling through time and trying only to find out that they were actually part of the past and that all of these events already actually happened. And you know, whenever you try and change things, something happens. Time, it's the fabric of space-time, works against you to keep you from making changes so you can't go back and kill your own grandfather or whatever. These, I love these. I love these a lot. All right. The movie Happy Accidents, I just gave away part of Happy Accidents just by saying that. But man, if you haven't seen Happy Accidents yet based on my recommendation, because I've brought it up a bunch of times, man, you're missing out. It was a good movie. Time Crimes is maybe the single best treatment of this sort of time travel and is amazing. It is a Spanish language movie. Time Crimes is so cool. But 12 Monkeys, to list a movie that you've probably seen, the original Terminator, despite all of its silliness with time travel and changing the future and all of that in the later Terminator movies, which has always been a big plot point, is that we keep changing the past, changing the future. The original Terminator was actually set in an immutable time universe. The original Terminator wound up with, you know, the Terminator, Arnold Schwarzenegger, comes back in time to try and kill Sarah Connor so that John Connor is never born. But by doing so, Kyle comes back and winds up being John Connor's father. And the whole thing means that by sending people back to try and change things, all they did was ensure that this is what already had happened. That they seemingly set in motion the things that they were coming back to change or stop. I love that. And it's why the first Terminator is the only Terminator. I am sick and tired of people telling me that Terminator 2 is the best of the movies, because you know what? It's not. It's absolutely not, because it starts to play with all of this time travel silliness that, I'll get to that in a minute. Other examples of movies, time travel movies where the past can't be changed. Let's see, I went through those. The only one left that I've got is Frequently Asked Questions About Time Travel. British comedy with, what's his name? The guy from, the IT crowd, the IT crowd. Anyway, Frequently Asked Questions About Time Travel is a really cute British comedy, but also very serious about its time travel. And, I really love that one. But, okay. That's those. Now, ones that I like a little less, but they can still be really good. It's ones where the past is flexible, where you can go back and change the past, and we wind up doing a bunch of things to change the past. And when you do that, the problem I have with them is that it leads to some real serious logical consistencies because, The Butterfly Effect is a great example of this type of movie, and The Butterfly Effect is exactly what my problem with them is when you go back and change the past, with The Butterfly Effect, you have no idea how this is going to change the future, and the fact that making any changes to the past means that there is practically zero chance that you will ever get to a point in the future where you are able to travel back to make changes to the past. It's just making changes to the past means that you're never there to travel back. Just not going to happen. The logical problems of this are just terrible. I mean, you can still make good ones. Looper. I loved Looper, even though, boy, the more you think about it, Looper had some really silly stuff with making changes to the past, and here a character in the future, present, whatever it is able to watch the effects of those changes in real time. Really silly stuff.
Looper all about looping back in time to try and change stuff, but it always keeps on doing the same thing?
No, actually, Looper is about for some reason, a society where it's impossible to kill people and get away with it, for some reason. So what they do is they have people in the past who they hire as assassins. And those people show up and they wait at a specific spot, and then all of a sudden someone from the future that they want to kill gets sent back in time to arrive at that particular spot at that particular time, and then whoever it is that's in the past that's paid to do this then kills that person. So now they're murdered in the past, so that you can get away with the crime in the future. Again, a lot of serious, weird, silly logic in Looper, and that's the downfall of it, but still a great story. It was a really engaging, and I loved that movie. Really loved it, despite how silly it was. Primer. Now, Primer is one that is really good about handling the flexible nature of time and being able to make changes in time while trying to still keep the whole movie consistent. And I think it succeeded at it, but you know, it's Primer, so you really, doesn't matter how many times you watch it, that thing is still a tangled mess. It's so hard to follow the logic in that film. But man, enjoyed every moment of it. But there's also, and now, this is usually in the time is flexible category, but you got a lot of movies. We have to save the past or save time in general, or basically you're going on a rescue mission, like in Time Cop, that someone's gone into the past to make changes to things. So now Time Cop has to go back there to try and save time. Although actually in Time Cop, he was just going back to save his wife because he was selfish that way. But things like the movie Back to the Future. Back to the Future is one of the best known and most beloved time travel movies. And you have to, you go back to save time. And, the problem is that, just by showing up there and his presence causes his parents to not get together. And so therefore he should have instantly just vanished. I mean, like we've already caused a logical paradox, and yet we play out this movie with him, things about his life and himself slowly fading away, that like the changes like take a while to take effect. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's still a fun movie. A lot of fun. But
wait, hold on.
But again, that's the silliness of it. Yes, sir.
1 second.
Okay. He's chewing, so it'll take a while.
This is another pun. He goes to the past to fix it, and then goes back to the future.
Yes, that was the whole reason they titled it that way. Is they have to, he winds up accidentally traveling in time, making changes there. Well, he has to fix those so that he can get back to the future. That's the whole point. I know. Have you ever watched Back to the Future?
No.
Oh, all right. We got to watch Back to the Future, dude.
Wait, was it an 80s movie?
Yes, it was an 80s movie, and it was awesome in the 80s, but, it's still kind of awesome today, too. So,
yeah, do that for an awesome in the 80s.
All right, I will watch Back to the Future with you.
Yeah, right. Aiden.
All right. I think Aiden has seen it, though, but it doesn't matter. Maybe you can do an awesome in the 80s with me.
Yeah.
All right, but there's a bunch of movies like that one. So in addition to Back to the Future, Time Cop, Peggy Sue Got Married, Hot Tub Time Machine kind of uses that conceit, 13 going on 30. And mostly, they work best when they're lighthearted comedies, when they're not taking the time travel part of it too seriously, and it's more about the people and the emotions and the drama of the situation. But there's a couple that do work it out. I mean, like the Terminator movie, the first Terminator movie, like 12 Monkeys. These are ones where we went back to save the past, but then we find out that you can't. It's just not possible.
In a time travel movie,
yes,
is what I would call a time fixer paradox, where when you try to change the past, time itself will cause some change in history to set it back on course.
Uh-huh.
That's
yes.
One of my favorite paradoxes in a movie.
That's very cool. That's very similar to some stuff I was talking about while you were out of the room. That's very cool. All right. Okay. Last of all, we got the gimmick movies. And these are ones that, boy, in a way you can almost say that they're not even really time travel movies. They just happen to have time travel in them. And it's usually just a gimmicky thing to either provide a convenient solution to something or to get us to where the plot is. I would put, in fact, Time After Time that Kaz brought up. Honestly, the time travel is just to get, H.G. Wells and Jack the Ripper into modern day New York so that they can then have an adventure. The time travel itself is not integral to the story, except it's just how the characters get to where they are. Austin Powers does that. The Planet of the Apes movie does that. The whole time travel sort of thing, of moving, you know, far into the future. It's just a matter of getting our human astronaut into a situation where someone from our day can see what the hell is going on with all this stuff. Let's see. X-Men Days of Future Past, kinda gimmicky, it's a save the past sort of thing, but really, the time travel is just a gimmick for them so that they could reset the universe and get to keep making movies the way they wanted to make them and get rid of some of the old continuity. So, Star Trek IV is gimmicky. Doctor Strange, Superman and Superman 2. I have gone on and on about how much I dislike Superman and Superman 2.
How did Doctor Strange? All right.
Yeah.
The whole turning back time.
Yes.
Fixing
everything. And remember now in Doctor Strange, and this is, I actually have a note here that says, look, gimmick movies still do cool stuff with time travel. Doctor Strange, that was an awesome movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the whole time-turning thing at the end, he created this time loop effect, which is how he defeated Dormammu in the end, and it was really cool, trapping the villain into a time loop through which the only way to get out of it was...
No.
Go ahead.
What he did is what I think he did was, right before he died, he reversed time.
Uh-huh.
So he would come back saying the same thing. So it's like, Dormammu, I have a deal. Stab. Dormammu, I have a deal. Eviscerate. Dormammu, I have a deal. Stop it!
I liked that use of time travel. Doctor Strange wasn't a whole time travel movie, but it used time travel really effectively in that one. Another one that does that, and it's weird to say this about it, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Look, Bill and Ted, I get that Bill and Ted is about time travel. It's them going back in the past and collecting historical figures for a book report. But all of that was a bunch of silliness just to get these characters together and put them in weird situations and all that. The fact that, that they could kidnap Socrates and Napoleon and Abraham Lincoln and Joan of Arc and that they could kidnap all of these people, reveal to them the modern future and then somehow go put them all back and it has no effect on history and that it's, there's a lot of silliness involved in it. But also, you gotta remember, Bill and Ted did some really cool stuff with time travel, especially with the scenes at the police station and dealing with his dad and when they're in the police station, he's like, all of a sudden, okay, don't forget garbage can. Don't forget garbage can. And then at that moment, the garbage can drops on someone. They placed they used the time machine to go back in time and place a tape recorder in the corner that would come on at the right moment to act as a distraction. When they finally find, I need to go back in time to a time before my dad lost his keys and then bring them back and leave them here somewhere so I can find them. And, oh, look, there they are. Hey, I guess you did take your dad's keys. They did some really cool stuff with time travel in that one. And I love Bill and Ted, for all of its fun and silliness and humor. But I also thought their treatment of time travel was pretty cool. Even Peabody and Sherman did some cool time travel tricks. Again, it was the same that Peabody and Sherman is still very much a Bill and Ted sort of movie where they go around mucking about in time and yet don't have a whole lot of real effect on time because Yeah, I mean, it's a silly, goofy kids movie, but they still had some cool time travel tricks in it, and it was very interesting. So there you go. Now, to wrap up time travel movies, now that I've covered all of them that I thought were important for this list, I got to hit Donnie Darko just because I don't have a category for Donnie Darko, and I don't know that I get Donnie Darko. I've seen it a couple of times. I enjoyed it, he said with a question mark, and yet Donnie Darko is just weird. I've seen it twice. I went on and I read a summation of it and a whole explanation of the plot, and I did all this review of it before, you know, while I'm putting together all my time travel movie stuff, and I'm doing my research on it so I can speak authoritatively about what Donnie Darko was about and what kind of category it falls into, and I still don't quite get it. I know I like it. I don't quite get it. That, yeah, I know. You like the cat toy. Yeah. But the cat toy is not appropriate for a podcast. Not yet. So anyway, that was Donnie Darko. I don't care. So I've now covered time travel movies. Clearly, I don't have to say anything more about it. I can just scratch this off my list and never have to worry about it returning until, of course, you know, I go see Happy Death Day or some other cool time travel movie, and then I'll talk about that because I'm going to do that. All right, that's it. That's it. We're all done. Man, we're an hour in. I've covered everything on my master list. Well, almost everything on my master list. Now it's time for the pod. Hot dog. This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble, and he rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that is where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? Then you send your question or topic to me by email, or better yet, in a private message on my forums, and I will add it to my Pod-O-Matic list. Because Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. All right, and before I go into it, for those of you who are new to the podcast, I mean, I know I go through that explanation of the Pod-O-Matic really fast, but honestly, people send me questions, suggestions, and then I put them in my giant list of Pod-O-Matic stuff, and then every week before I start the podcast, I just randomly sort out the list so I can take 100 of them off the top, and that 100, when I hit R2 here, there you go. R2 is in a Pop-O-Matic bubble. He rolls me some dice, and I get a number from 1 to 100. That I just take that number off the list and that's where we go. So it really is this fully randomized list based on whatever you guys send me. The first number I rolled this week is 34. 34 is from my brother Kyle. And Kyle says, I just want to thank you for suggesting Angie Tribeca. Someone else had suggested it to me, but didn't explain it was basically a modern police squad. So funny, so good. What is your next recommendation? First off, Angie Tribeca is really that guy. I mean, when my brother says it is a modern police squad, that's exactly how to describe it. You go watch the old police squads, the old airplane movies, that level of comic book cartoony silliness in a live action show, that's exactly what you're looking at. It is characters with names created just so they can make a stupid pun a couple of times, or even, and sometimes, usually it's pretty obvious. I mean, Jay Giles as her partner, you know, some of the names are pretty obvious, but some of them, it's a name that they created just so that they could then make a pun, you know, an hour later, you know, two episodes later, suddenly, oh, now they're going to make a pun on that name. And it's just silliness, but it's really funny and really good. So I love Angie Tribeca. What is my next recommendation? Look, right now, if you're not watching The Tick, you need to get Amazon Prime and you need to watch The Tick on Amazon because...
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, that got him back to the table.
Let me tell you about The Tick.
Go ahead. Tell him about The Tick. Don't give anything away, but just...
Basically, Arthur's just walking around and all of us... spying on these people who he believes...
What, we don't need to give him a plot summary. We need to tell him it's awesome.
I'm quickly All right, explaining go ahead. The entrance of Tick. He's spying on these people who he believes works for Terror, the biggest bad guy that it ever existed.
Uh-huh.
And then, all of a sudden, this giant muscular blue man with a not quite that fine... superhero costume comes up with antennas and is like, well, this is quite a pickle, or something like that. And yeah. He makes puns a lot of the time with his sentences.
See, he had never, listen, Noah has never seen the original Tick TV show, although it is also on Amazon and we're going to be watching that too. But he's never seen the original Tick TV show. He's never seen the cartoon. To him, the Tick is brand new. And so I've now watched most of the series at least twice because I watched the pilot by myself a while back. And then, well, Aiden wanted to watch. I'm like, all right, well, cool. Let's watch the pilot again. So we watched the pilot again so we could then go through and start watching the rest of them when they came out. And then I started watching episode one. Well, that's when Eli and Noah came in. They're like, what are you watching? I'm like, ah, hold on. Let's roll back and watch the pilot one more time. So we watched the pilot again so they could see it. And then we watched episodes one and two. And then Aiden came around and said, wait a minute, you guys watched without me? So the next night we started over again with episodes one and two. Now we're all caught up and I think they're up to episode six now. And it is so good.
How I'm counting it is episode one is the pilot. Yes. How it describes it on Amazon. And then episode two and three are amazing. And episode six on Amazon is where we left off. They haven't gotten anything more than that, but it's amazing.
It is the same sort of humor that you're used to from previous incarnations of it. And the same sort of silliness. It is a world of superheroes, but we're deconstructing and pointing out some of the ludicrous things about this sort of world. And really humanizing the characters. I mean, they get lots of really mundane things going on in their lives while also being superheroes at the same time. But it is a dark, dark show. The Terror as the ultimate supervillain is just pure evil. I mean, so evil, and I wish I could reveal more to you than that.
He's just mean to his own people, and the one pyramid leader is just so passive aggressively the meanest. Like Miss Lint is about to leave the car.
All right, you've said too much. You've said too much. They've got to watch it. All right, no, don't be sorry. Just don't say too much. Is really good, and the Terror. By the way, this is not really terribly relevant. But the Terror, the ultimate evil, is played by Jackie Earle Haley, who I saw that was who was in the credits. I don't recognize his face. I mean, under all that makeup. And so I thought, okay, where have I heard that name before? Why is that name so familiar? And so I go back and I look at his credits. I'm like, oh, he was Rorschach. That's why I recognize the name. I remember Jackie Earle Haley was Rorschach, but, you know, we never saw Rorschach's face, so that didn't help me at all. So then I go back to, well, actually we did later in the movie, but anyway, that's not the point. So then I'm looking further back into his credits, and the only other thing I've ever seen Jackie Earle Haley in, I've seen him in The Tick, I've seen him in Watchmen, and oh yeah, he was that teen bad boy heartthrob kid from Bad News Bears? Seriously? Like the original Bad News Bears? Like way back? Really? I had no idea. That was just weird. But anyway, I recommend The Tick. Number 51. 51 is from, there it is. It is from someone called Mrs. Darks. Hey, Mrs. Darks. And she says, what about Dothan would you change if you had to? Dothan being my Pathfinder character. She is a half-orc bard, and she is my favorite character I've ever played. Oh, God, she has her wings now, by the way. I finally finished constructing the wings. Did I tell you about this or not? Anyway, she has wings. She flies. She's awesome. All right. What would I change about Dothan if I had to? All right, I've mentioned this one before. I would not have had her kill Sudo in cold blood the way she did way back in book one. There was something I was going for there, and later it turns out that no, that was really out of character for what I wanted to do with her. And so, I would change that fact of her history. Other than that, I think I probably, I don't know. As far as her actual stats and, I would change that about her personality, I wouldn't have had her do that particular action. But, as far as her stats, man, I really like the way she's played out. I mean, maybe if she had some wisdom. Although, I know that's part of her ADHD. It's part of her character that she's got the wisdom of seven. But, man, there's been so many times that I really wished she had, you know, even just a 10, just an average wisdom would have been so nice. But, you know, her will save is horrifying. But, nah, not much. I mean, at this point, we're still playing out this game. So, I love her. I absolutely love her. I'm going to keep riding this thing out to the very end because this is great. So, yeah, I don't have a better answer than that. Number 91. 91 is from, look at that. It's from Kaz. And Kaz says, pitch us a DC comic team. What four heroes have gotten together to fight unspeakable evil? A DC comic team. Oh man, you are making this rough on me, but okay. If I've got to put together four DC heroes, okay, hold on. I just had a horrible coughing fit, and so I had to pause the podcast while I was coughing. And then when I got done, I asked Noah, dude, what would you put? What four heroes would you pick for a DC team? And he said,
Batman, Superman, The Flash, and Wonder Woman.
Yeah, he said the Justice League, basically, and then he drank all my soda. So, what I'm saying is he's a bad child, if you hadn't caught that. I don't know. Look, if I had to put together a team of DC heroes, I don't know DC so well. I just don't, they don't jump to mind.
I only know two teams, Justice League and Teen Titans, and I already made a team.
Yeah, so,
it's not Justice League, though. I made another one besides my Justice team.
I might pick, like, Oracle to be, like, team leader and give us the be the man in the chair, as it were. Woman in
Who's
the chair
Oracle?
In this case. Oracle used to be Batgirl, Barbara Gordon. But then she was in an accident and she wound up in a wheelchair. And so now she goes by Oracle and she does a lot of the computer and background research work and coordinating and things like that.
Okay.
At least from what I understand. I'm no expert on any of these.
Okay. I've actually got a good idea for one.
Okay. Go ahead.
Raven from Teen Titans.
I was going to say Raven from Teen Titans.
Cyborg.
Okay. That's still Teen Titans.
But here's the thing.
What, Robin and Beast Boy?
No!
With Starfire?
No!
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Have a bad guy as well.
Okay.
A bad guy turned good.
Okay, which bad guy?
Why not Joker?
Okay,
you never know what he's
going
to pull.
Not Joker. Joker is too ultimate evil.
Okay.
But look, you can still do that.
Bane. There we go.
I got one.
What do you got, Eli?
I got Suicide Squad.
Oh, yeah.
Just there you go. Those he just guys. Put together the Suicide Squad. Look, I would do Oracle, Raven, and I want to keep this mostly street level, and I know Raven really kind of defies the whole street level idea, but we could work around that. We would find a reason to keep her magic at a slightly lower level for this particular comic.
No.
And then Green Arrow, maybe, or maybe whoever his – who's Green Arrow's sidekick? What's his name? Speedy? I can't remember. Maybe that one.
I forgot about those guys.
Yeah.
And
I wind up with Oracle, Green Arrow, Raven, and then a fourth probably Blue Beetle. Now, I don't know how this team is really going to come together because once you throw Blue Beetle in, it's really kind of comedy. He's really, he's meant to be teamed up with Booster Gold and they can just do all comedy. But those would be the four I would put together. I don't know quite how that would work. It would really rely on Oracle bringing them together and making them a cohesive team, but I think I could do it. But that's my best guess. And I'm mostly picking four of my favorite characters. Not so much how well they work together. Cause again, I don't know DC all that well, but that's my best bet.
Quickly add my true list.
Okay, what's your true list?
I'm going to keep Oracle, because, like, maybe we have, like, super friends or something.
Okay.
And have Cyborg, definitely. I love him.
Okay, Cyborg is your favorite.
Then, Probably the Flash and Green Arrow.
Okay. That's not bad. So Flash and Green Arrow would be the two that have TV shows. We've never watched Green Arrow. We have been watching The Flash. But we haven't seen Green Arrow yet. Although you saw Green Arrow show up in The Flash.
Yeah.
So there you go. So you're familiar with him from there, too.
Yeah. And then, who'd have for the crazed little sidekick? Oh, yeah. I'm sorry for keeping The Flash going, but I'm going to have the hacker.
Oh. Well, no, but Oracle can do that for us, though.
I'm actually gonna replace her with him.
Oh, man.
Cause, seriously, he's great.
Okay. But then that's an all-male team. You sure you want to be sexist?
Well, I have three characters so far, since I'm replacing Oracle.
Well, but, oh, that's true. That's true.
And then I'm probably going to have, probably Wonder Woman.
There you go. See? That would balance out. Wonder Woman was an awesome movie, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Man, I love Wonder Woman. Okay, there we go. Finally, 51. That doesn't help me. All right, 64. Let's try that one. And 64 is from... It's from Kyle. And Kyle says, I'm thinking of starting a new fake candidate for president in 2020 along the lines of Ron Weasley for Muggle president. Right now, I'm using Carol Danvers as my placeholder, although... I might go with her ultimately, but for sure, I've got my VP announcement, Bruce Banner. Thoughts? Ooh. All right, Carol Danvers and Bruce Banner for president. I'm good with Carol Danvers, but if you go with a superhero as the main character, or as the main character, as the presidential candidate, don't you really have to go across genres to find a running mate? I mean, because I really like the idea of Carol Danvers. Bruce Banner? Man, Bruce Banner as a VP is spectacular. I mean, because the whole point of a VP candidate when you're on the campaign trail is your VP is in some ways like Luther, Obama's anger translator. The VP, like Joe Biden, gets to be your attack dog. They get to go out and say stuff on the campaign trail that the president wouldn't say themselves because they're way too dignified for that, but the VP candidate can make these kinds of insinuations, and Joe Biden was a pro at that. Now, Trump didn't need any such thing because he's his own attack dog, but traditionally, that's the point of the VP candidate. One, you get him from a state, a constituency that you didn't think you could draw on your own. And then two, he goes out and he says all the stuff that you're thinking but don't say. So that's pretty awesome. Now, keeping that role in mind, how awesome is Bruce Banner as your attack dog VP on the campaign trail? I mean, look.
If you vote for someone else besides Ron, I will get angry and you won't like me when I'm angry.
The whole idea that Bruce Banner is constantly, like the middle of every single campaign speech, he's going to transform into the Hulk. That makes me super happy. In which case, if that's the case, yeah, you're going to have to go with someone other than Carol Danvers. I don't think you should go with two superheroes. But a Hulk as a VP that's nuts. That is awesome. I mean, look, he's a brilliant, world-renowned scientist. He is, he has all the qualifications needed to be a great leader, a great VP. He's awesome at it. And oh yeah, he also transforms into the Hulk on the campaign trail all the damn time. I love that.
If he's vice president, he should be running with Tony Stark.
Oh, man. I hate Tony Stark. That guy's a jerk. I mean, no, that's perfectly valid for you. I'm totally with you. But he's not one of my favorites.
America, there we go.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would love to have Captain America as president. But
he's literal president. He's captain of the United States.
Mm. Captain America's awesome. Steve Rogers is just the coolest. All right. Anyway, I don't know who you're going to get, but... consider Smog the Dragon. I don't know. Could be anybody. So.
I'm sorry. Did you just say Smog the Dragon?
Yeah. Smog the Dragon with the Hulk as his... Well, no. Now, Smaug is too big and physically powerful himself. He would kind of overshadow, even though Hulk is technically stronger, it would kind of overshadow the whole effect of the Hulk in the first place. Don't use Smaug. Maybe Samwise Gamgee. I've always thought, yeah, he's not the brightest bulb, but he knows what's right and wrong. He is, I mean, Ron Weasley wasn't the brightest bulb, but he made a great candidate, right? So, maybe Samwise Gamgee, Bruce Banner, the Gamgee Banner ticket. I'm on board with that. But anyway, I've already rolled. Well, do you have something to add? I'm sorry, I shouldn't interrupt you.
You should have Hulk as president,
mm-hmm.
but he gives up on the whole I'm gonna go help the Avengers, and have his vice president just be someone just as angry.
Oh man, a dual anger ticket.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, we're on 34 now.
I call it the anger management group.
34. Oh wait, no, we already did 34. God damn it! These dice are not cooperating. 10. And 10 is, it's from Kyle again. Surprise, surprise. And Kyle says, let's say you happen to accidentally discover evidence that convinces you 100% that you are a simulation living in a simulation. Okay. What do you do with that information? I don't know. If I have solid evidence that convinces me 100% that I'm living in the Matrix, or whatever the equivalent of the Matrix is in this scenario, then I would probably, oh man, I would want to share that with people who can do something about it. I mean, essentially, if we know we're living in a simulation, like we know for sure, then this is our chance to talk to our creators, as it were, to talk to a higher power. Although, once we talk to them and they realize that we're now self-aware as a universe, does that mean that they'll just terminate the experiment? I mean, do they just cut us off? Or does morality say that, you know, that those of us living in this simulation are real enough that we're actually, you know, sentient people, that we're actually beings, that, I don't know. I don't know how they'd handle it. That would be really tough. I mean, cause look, the other option is to just go on about your life and pretend you didn't know. You know, because even if it's a simulation, if there's nothing you can do about it, I'm still living my life. It's still real to me. Even if I know it's created from somewhere else, so what? It's still real. It's still, you know, the fact that it's generated by whatever, computer equivalent this advanced civilization has, it doesn't change the fact that it's still real, you know, whether it's made up of actual subatomic particles, quarks, and whatever, or whether it's made up of bits in a computer, who cares? It's still us, and we're still faced with the same situations and the same choices, and it's still real. So, I don't know what I would do. I would mostly probably just talk in circles until I convince myself that I don't need to do anything and I can just go back to my life as usual. That sounds like me. 26. 26 is, it's from Jacob. Jacob says, why, God darn it, Jacob, I forgot about this one. Why isn't Lenny Bruce afraid? Furthermore, what is the significance of the initials LB? I have no idea where the LB comes from in these lyrics. Lenny Bruce is not afraid because he challenged authority at every turn, and mocked authority. That was the whole point of his stand-up routine, is mocking the conventions that people, considered unmockable, that it was just too inappropriate. He was testing boundaries and limits. And while I'm not a huge fan of Lenny Bruce comedy, I do respect what it was he was doing in his day. So that's why he's not afraid. But the significance of the initials LB, other than it's Lenny Bruce, I have no idea. Really have no idea. I don't know where this question came from. Lucille Ball? Larry Bird? I've got nothing. 11. And 11 will be our last one, I think. So, I lost my list. There it is, I found it. Huh, I'm good at this. All right, 11 comes from Kyle. And Kyle says, bed, wet, or behead. Oh, there's a good way to end this. Bed, wet, or behead. Still alive Hitler, circa World War II. An uncooked raw chicken from the grocery store stuffed with Roquefort cheese that has been unrefrigerated for a week. Or that chimp that ate that lady's face off, but 2 weeks before he ate that lady's face off. Okay. Then, I'm not taking any chances with the chimp. You know what? Yeah, I'm gonna kill Hitler. Clearly.
Duh.
Clearly you have to kill Hitler.
I'm gonna marry the chicken.
So. Really? I'm gonna marry the chimp.
Yeah.
I'm gonna marry the chimp and put it in a cage and, give it away to a zoo. I mean, we'll still remain married. Lord knows. Oh, wait. I have to live with them forever. But with the chimp in a cage. I'm gonna cheat and put that chimp in a cage. There's just no way.
And at the time of our life with a raw chicken.
Yeah,
no,
that's...
I'm gonna live forever with a raw chicken while it's in my stomach.
Ugh. Yeah, no. No, you know what? Okay, I'll marry the sandwich and
the chicken.
It's a chicken. It's just a chicken. Alright, I'll marry the raw chicken and then bed the chimp though. Oh man, you're gonna get your face torn off. That is,
no,
I mean,
this
it's. I know
a few
it's
weeks before he wants. To
right, well, right, but his attitude is still not good. Clearly, he has the propensity for eating people's faces. So, yeah, no. Marry the chimp because I have to kill Hitler. So I'm going to marry the chimp and put it in a cage so it never gets close to me. I will imprison my partner. I don't care. And then that just leaves me to bed the chicken, which is terrible, but it's the only choice I've got.
It's raw from the grocery store. You bought a chicken in a chimp in a cage, a time travel machine, which happened to bring Hitler back.
Yeah, you know what? It's not pretty.
And then you also bought some raw chicken.
Raw chicken stuffed with Roquefort dressing that's not been refrigerated for a week. So the whole thing is rotting and smelly and gross.
Ugh.
You know what? I'm done talking about
it.
No, this is over. It's over.
For Christmas, but you forgot to cook
it. We are all done. Oh, God, that was terrifying. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to GLaDOS and let her recap the episode while I recover.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2017 by Nerd Pride Radio. The opening and closing theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. My bumper music this week was Weezer's In the Garage. She Blinded Me with Science as performed by William Shatner. And was that it? I think that was it. I can't remember. I think that was it. Anyway, all the songs I use are available on iTunes. Check them out, buy them, enjoy them. I wouldn't put them in my podcast if I didn't love them. Don't forget, this podcast is a proud member of the Nerd Pride Network, Angry Geeks Versus, Me Like Trivia, and Nerd Pride Radio itself, quality nerd podcasting from quality nerd people. If you want to help out Nerd Pride, subscribe to this cast in iTunes or whatever podcatcher you use. Write us a nice review. Give us 5 stars. But if you want to do something super nice, recommend it to your friends. Because if you're enjoying this, please spread the word and let other people enjoy it as well. Word of mouth is my bread and butter, people. Remember, I am always looking for you listeners to do my work for me. Don't forget to send me questions and topics for the Podomatic. Watch out every week on the forums and Facebook for listener betrayal. And if you have a really interesting nerd fact about an upcoming episode number, send it to me and save me all that grueling research. Oh, my contact information, mike@nerdprideradio.com, @nerdprideradio on Twitter, facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But to be completely honest, the very best way to talk to me is come sign up for my forums at nerdprideradio.com/nerds. Sign up. Send me a message. We will hang out together and become best friends in the world. We'll have fun. And now it's time for listener betrayal. Before I start recording every podcast, I go out to Facebook and I go out to my forums and I post up, hey guys, I am recording anything you say there. It gets read off right here at the end of the podcast, which is what I'm doing right now. So I'm going to start off with, let's do Facebook this time. And, several responses. First one is from Kaz. Kaz says, F, marry, kill. So bed, wet, or behead. Betsy DeVos, Ryan Zinke, Jeff Sessions. I don't know who Ryan Zinke is, so why don't I go look that up? Because I know my opinions on the other two, and I'm clearly going to behead, and then whoever this dude is. So hold on. Ryan Zinke. Okay. And Google tells me that this dude is, there it is. Congress must challenge Ryan Zinke's attack on national monuments. Secretary Zinke? Seriously? I'm not even aware of this guy's name. Oh, currently serving as the 52nd United States Secretary of the Interior. And, all right, look, we're going to behead Jeff Sessions. Let's just start with that, because Jeff Sessions is doing far more damage to this country than any other Trump appointee at this moment. So, Jeff Sessions has to go. The man is dangerous. The man was too racist to be a presidential appointee in the 90s. Do you know how racist you have to be too racist for the 90s? Or was it late 80s? I don't remember. It was 25, 30 years ago. And he was too racist then. The man has not changed. He's not changed at all. And yet he gets to be, he gets to be in charge of justice in this country. This is horrifying. Horrifying that this man is our attorney general. Yeah, absolutely, behead. Now, that leaves me with DeVos and Zinke, both of whom seem to be terrifying and terrible. Zinke, I just know just now, but you have not left me any good options. So, I am going to, I'm going to bed Betsy DeVos. Because I know, but what choice do I have? I've already used up my behead on Jeff Sessions. So I'm going to bed Betsy DeVos, and then that way I don't have to ever see her again. That's the fastest way to get rid of her. And then I don't even know what Ryan Zinke looks like. I don't know who he is. I assume he's just as insufferable as the rest, but this? I'm now married to him for the rest of my life default. Whoa. So what?
You've never heard of him. You haven't heard of any horrible things he's been doing. So, I mean, how bad could he be?
Oh, yeah. How bad could he be? No, he's still awful. Yeah, he's just, since I haven't heard of him, that makes him the least awful of the three.
Right.
Oh, yeah. This is all bad. You're not helping me at all here, Kaz. You're a bad man. Next up is Sarah Beth, who says, car shopping should have been a circle of hell in Dante's Inferno. Any tips beyond my type A notebook of research? No, that's what I do. I do the big notebook of research. I get all the stuff that I need and want, and then I shop around online, find places that I can go look at that are within 100 miles of me. You're doing the same thing I would do. I don't have any tips because I hate car shopping. So there you go. But Sarah Beth then continues with, are you excited about the last season on the Black Tapes? Only 4 episodes to go. No. Why would you do that to me? I got out. I unsubscribed and never looked back. Oh, man. I got rid of all of those because I was so dissatisfied with what they were doing to me. They tease and they tease and they promise. And then every single one of them is like the third season of Lost. It's just terrible. I am so glad to be away from them. And now you're going to tell me that, wait, this is the final season? Like, they're going to wrap it all up and give me a whole bunch of answers? Now you're tempting me to go back. No, I refuse. I'm sticking with Sayer. Sayer's back, and Sayer is awesome every single time. There is not a disappointing moment in Sayer. That's where I'm staying for my story podcast. See, Black Tapes can drop dead. That's it. All right. Kyle says, did you like my package? Were you happy to get your hands on it? You do have an impressive package. However, I have not handled it as of yet. So I'm going to defer my opinion until later. How's that? And then Flameblade, Flameblade says, no captioning as usual. I'm sorry. This is okay. Flame, this is a message directly from me to you. I am I am sorry that we do not have a written transcript of this podcast. I'm sorry that I can't provide any closed captioning services for you. I feel terrible, and I hope, Flame, that you can accept my sincere and humble apology presented to you on my podcast.
Can you do me a favor?
In audio format.
Can you do me a favor?
Yeah, what's that?
Can you come out with an hour and a half long video that's nothing but a black screen with the things you say running across it without sound?
No. No, I can't do any of that, and that's what he's complaining about, because he can't hear.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, no. You should send him an entire, like, transcript of everything you said this week and email it to him every week.
Oh, my God, yeah, except I'm not going to do that
if
because
you're gonna
I don't
be a
have
good
that.
Radio host, that's what you do.
Yes, no, a good radio host would do that. I am not that, so therefore, I'm sorry. No, this is, again, my apology from me to Flame. Flame, I hope you're listening. I am so sorry. So sorry. Okay, now, enough of that. Let's go over to my website. Over at my forums, I have many responses here as well. Talvin, who just got done with surgery, Talvin says, "So what did I miss at the end of Thursday's Rune Lord sessions? Session. Did everyone die? Well, no, we were fighting a demon, and then the paladin in round two gets a lucky, well, okay, not lucky, he's a paladin, that's what he does. Critical hit, severs the demon's spine, and the demon dies. I mean, well, or at least he was incapacitated. So, let's see, yes?
I just want you to share what you do with hors d'oeuvres.
Oh, okay, alright, let me share. That's my lovely wife. And here's the deal. We're going to a birthday party tonight. It's a surprise party. It's her 40th. Don't tell her. Okay. And there's not going to be a dinner served, but there will be certainly hors d'oeuvres, snack food, this kind of thing. And so my wife wants to prepare our children for how you handle a place that has hors d'oeuvres. And look, it's not appropriate to go in there loading up your plate with stuff. This is not intended to be a meal. We're eating ahead of time. You know, you go up, you get a couple of the things that you like, and then you go back, but it's just for snacking. It's not to load up.
And then...
No, I'm going to tell this part, and you can give your answer.
Okay.
She then says, okay, so what if you're there, and you're with some of your friends or cousins or whatever, and they're ahead of you in line, and they load up their plate, and they take way too much stuff, and they load up their plate. What would you do then?
And I say, eat off of theirs.
Yeah, eat off of their plate.
And you. I said it all while walking away.
And here's the problem. I mean, it's a smart-ass answer, but I can't find any flaw with it. So, I guess, you know, you're right. That would actually be an appropriate way to handle it. Now you get the extra food, and it's their fault because they took too much. I got nothing on this one. So, all right. Anyway. End of Rune Lord session. No, severed the demon's spine, and then we went around the corner and we're facing off with the scorpion hell dog, whatever things they are. And it seems like we're going to handle them pretty quickly, but then, a couple of reptilian humanoid, I don't know what they are, some sort of minor demon thing, devil, I don't know what they are, showed up behind us, and now there's some sort of, ghostly spellcaster behind them, and we're just getting mobbed. We're getting really mobbed here. So, no, we haven't all died, but, you know, we kind of just left it there in the middle of the round. So, I have no idea what's going to happen now. I'm looking forward to the next session. Now, Talon then says, Betty Botter bought some butter, but she said this butter's bitter. If I put it in my batter, will it make my batter bitter? But a bit of better butter will make my batter better. So 'twas better Betty Butter bought a bit of better butter. Okay, that's good enough. Followed by Talvin, who says, I thought a thought, but the thought I thought wasn't the thought I thought I thought. If the thought I thought I thought had been the thought I thought, I wouldn't have thought so much. Not bad. All right, and then Talvin gives me a bedwetter behead, Metropolitan Edition, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles. That's easy. I would marry Chicago and live there forever, because I love Chicago. I've been there a couple times. I love Chicago. It's a great town. I would bed Los, well, either one would work. I can go either way. I think I would bed New York. Just the excitement, the whirlwind of it. I think it would be really cool. Just one time. That's all. You know? And then it's all over. And then that just leaves me to behead Los Angeles because, you know, it's the last one left. But I could have switched those two. I could easily have my affair with Los Angeles and kill New York. Either one works. And then the European edition, London, Paris, Berlin. Ooh, that's pretty good.
Ooh.
I'm going to marry London because we share a language in common. I think it would be a little easier on me. And then again, I can switch the other two either way, but, probably have my affair with Berlin because I like Germany and I would love to visit there and that would be cool. And then, you know, I just have to kill Paris. So, I mean, you know, again, not because I don't like Paris, but because that's the last one left. DM Dark says, too bad we never got to play Master of Wills. The creator said he'd be willing to talk with you if you ever wanted to interview him, though. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I really, man, I should give him a call, send him an email, something. Because that was a good game. Well, at least from whatever everyone who played it told me it was a good game. I wish we had played. Next year, we'll have our turn. Kyle says, assume that tomorrow convincing evidence is announced demonstrating that the hollow earth theory is correct. What do you do?
Cry.
Yes, I would be devastated and I would be doubtful and it would take a long time to convince me because would it shake your foundation in science and physics? Yeah, absolutely.
But because what foundation is there to shake?
Because there's... because... You know, all of science and physics ties together and coming up with something like the earth is actually hollow and that there's beings living on the inside would fundamentally change so many things that we know. Oh, no, that would be devastating. It's so out there that, yeah, I don't know how I would deal with it ultimately because it means that 90% of what I've believed is true is a lie. But man, that would be a rough one. So anyway, that's the end of the cast. So, you guys have been awesome. Say goodnight, children.
Goodnight, children.
All right. Say goodnight, R2. And,
wait, 1 second.
Hold on. He's got the cat.
Say
goodnight, Bear. That's Bear hitting the microphone. All right. I love you guys. It's been awesome. I'll see you next week. Bye.